In this episode of Movie Wireless, we talk about First Cow and The Invisible Man. Movie Wallace. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And Yazdi as well.
Movie Wallace is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news, and general banter in theatres. Movie Wallace is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news, and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming, or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you. Greetings.
Hello. You never normally get it wrong.
Well, I was going to edit that out, but since you mentioned it, yes, I tripped over my words doing the intro.
Which hardly ever happens.
Which very rarely happens.
Very rarely. I probably count on my hands.
I do. I practice every day for at least 10 minutes to make sure I get it right while live on air. And clearly, that didn't happen today.
It's okay. That's what makes it special.
That's right.
The Japanese, what is it called? There's a philosophy in Japanese culture about anything that you make with your own hands, if it's perfect, it has no value. It's the imperfections which give it.
Ooh, then we would be very valuable. Yes,
then this podcast is possibly the most valuable podcast
ever.
Yes.
Out
there. Yes.
So I have to bring something up as a tech guy. And I don't know if I should point it out or not, because I think it has the potential to spoil literally hundreds of movies.
Oh, so, then don't bring it up. Oh. Maybe you should say spoiler alert.
Well, spoiler alert for every movie. I don't know. Been bothering.
I think you should tell us first, and then we should judge whether we should bring it up or not.
No, this is a live podcast. I put it out there. It's going to have to go out into the world, and consequences be damned.
Okay.
So,
tell us.
Being the tech guy,
mm-hmm.
being the Apple guy, mm-hmm. I heard recently that Apple has a policy of...
Yes, I heard that too. That's true.
Okay.
Okay, I don't know the policy.
So this is what I heard.
It's true. You can tell the bad guy in a movie, right? Yeah.
So a lot of tech companies, a lot of product companies have this, you know, policy where, you know, if you want to depict their product in a movie, you have to secure permission. Now, you don't necessarily have to do that, but if they don't like what you do, they can come after you legally. So, you know, if you wanted to show, you know, a BMW car, for example, in a movie, you have to ask BMW's permission, and if
sure,
they're okay
yeah,
with it.
Sure, yeah, because you might be endorsing...
Right, it's how their brand is portrayed. Now, Apple apparently has been very, very liberal about the use of, you know, if you want to use an iPhone in your movie or a Mac computer or whatever, you can go ahead and do that. However, I think Ryan Johnson...
Inadvertently
came out and said that one of the clauses that Apple inserts into that release is that bad guys can't use Apple products. So
ooh.
Now I'm going to be looking everywhere in movies for if there is a couple of characters, one's using an iPhone and one's using an Android. I don't know who the bad guy is. Now, some movies, like, you know, superhero movies, conflicts, you know, good versus bad, not a big deal. But there are those movies where you might have, you know, a depiction of some...
Like Knives Out.
Who's the bad guy in Knives Out? Well, you know, maybe if you look a bit more closely, it'll be the one who doesn't use the iPhone. So, I don't know, that kind of thing really, like... I mean, I get Apple's trying to protect their brand, but really, I mean, if the iPhone is not used to bludgeon somebody to death, I don't know why they don't care. I mean, why they care? I mean, bad guys can have good taste in tech products too.
Yeah, it just seems so retro. It seems like so 1960s.
But no,
like something they would discuss on Mad Men.
Do feel like...
Chances are we wouldn't actually notice it, but I bet you it's all subliminal.
Well, that's the thing. Now I know, I'm going to see it everywhere. Every time somebody uses any kind of a tech device, I'll be like, if it's a PC, I'm like, that guy's up to no good. If it's a Mac, I'll be like, okay, that's our hero. Anyway, I don't know. I feel like it's going to change my world.
Or maybe it's Apple's way of just making sure that people continue to buy Apple products. You know,
look, bad guys are cool. I would be absolutely fine if
Depends
Bane used an iPhone.
Depends what type of bad guy. We need to go and watch John Wick again. Plenty of bad guys in that one.
There you go. Yeah, I would love to see a henchman brandishing a MacBook Pro. I mean, Anyway, this is my world and these are my anxieties. So let's segue into, we have only two movies this week, so we got a chance to do a Netflix pick in our segment of I can't find anything to watch on VOD. And I say VOD because many streaming services, this is our service to you. I haven't described it for a while, but again, if you're a long time listener of the show, you know that the three of us have really put it upon ourselves to help everyone out there who comes to us and asks, what do I watch on Netflix tonight? With a pick of a movie. And, you know, we talk about streaming shows, but, you know, ideally we try and find you a movie to watch tonight. So we have very full streaming queues. We use Amazon, we use Netflix, we use Hulu, mm-hmm. we use all of the Apple services, TV. Apple TV, now TV Plus. So, guys, what's in your Netflix or other streaming services queues?
Okay, I'm really excited about this one. So this is a documentary that Joe and I watched recently on Netflix, and it's called Bikram, Yogi Guru Predator. And it's about the hot yoga founder who was called Bikram Chowdhury. So hot yoga became all the rage in the early, late 90s into the early 2000s. And
this describe is what a hot really... yoga is, because you can't. You just said hot yoga.
Oh, yeah, hot yoga means a yoga class that's done at above a certain temperature, so that it means hot. That you're basically you sweat, the heat enables your muscles to be
become more supple.
Yes, all of that stuff. I just found the whole place very smelly.
It does. It smells of feet.
Yes, because it's just a sweat pit. Anyway, that said, this is a very well put together documentary that describes the phenomenon, the person who became, he was a rock star. He became almost a rock star, very, very famous. And then, you know, some strange things started to come to light about bad business practices, as well as his own, you know, taking it too far with his customers. Brilliant documentary, Bikram.
Okay. Yeah, Rashmi and I watched this one, and I think, you know, it's another one of these movies where we talk about the downfall of one of these, you know, very seemingly, you know, ego-driven rock star guru type characters that, you know, utilizes the power that they have in ways that one of, you know, in ways that, you know, I'll call it Harvey Weinstein style. I'll just drop it there. But yeah, very, very well made documentary. And I think what I liked about that more than anything was how it wasn't especially judgy, right? It to me, it felt like it was a description and portrayal of the facts and first accounts, but it wasn't necessarily, you know, out to get him. It was just the story of you know, what happened. So
what surprised me was how much archival footage there was.
Yeah. No, it's always surprising in these instances how...
Is this guy based in India or he's based in the US?
He was in the US, but now he's obviously fled.
Yeah, because I remember, I mean, I grew up in India and I'd never heard of hot yoga, you know, ever. And the first time I heard about it was after I came to the US and people were talking about, you know, yoga done at very high temperatures and sweaty rooms. And I understand it's a very effective way of losing weight very quickly if you want to do it to attend somebody's, you know, wedding or whatever and fit into your old clothes or what have you. But I'd never heard of such a thing. So it's probably somebody's idea, but...
The whole thing was very, very culty. And, you know, he developed kind of a following because he was thought of by, you know, I'll call them naive Californian types, mm-hmm. If you know the kind of person that speaks to, that he was something mystical and spiritual, and really he was a very good salesman. He was very good, and, you know, I'd imagine the hot yoga was just a differentiator, mm-hmm. Enabled him to kind of say his brand of yoga was superior. You know, he may have been a suggestion of it coming from you know, a very hot climate where, mm-hmm. you know, yoga is done, you know, versus a US more moderate climate. But anyway, it was a good pick, Rashmi. Okay. Yes, Dee, what you got?
My pick is a movie that I saw at the Tribeca Film Festival about 3 years ago, and it has not diminished at all in my love for it. I was just absolutely gobsmacked, smitten by the movie. I just came out like on a cloud because I was so happy having seen it. And since then, the lead of the movie passed away at a very young age. And I'm talking about Anton Yelchin.
Yes.
The wonderful actor who was in, you know, he was in the Star Trek movies.
Yeah, we know him best from the Star Trek days, but...
Yeah, and he's been in so... I mean, he was in his early 30s when he kind of died through a freak car accident. But this was one of his last movies that he made, and... it's the most unusual premise about this young man who kind of runs into a woman outside a New York hotel while he's going for a jog. Sorry, while she's going for a jog. And they start talking, and she's French and he's American. He's obviously much younger than her because he's, you know, a teen. He's going to college. And then they set up this... this time every evening when they jog together and they start talking about life and the world and everything.
Oh,
and
I remember you telling us about this.
And then they just develop this wonderful friendship. Just the dialogue between them is beautiful, and it's all done in long, long, long takes where they're just talking. And it's kind of like Before Sunrise in terms of seeing two people who are perfect for each other, who are just finding out things about each other. And eventually he finds out that she's married to a foreign diplomat who is much, much older. And, you know, it's really good. Glenn Close is in it in a very small part as Anton Yelchin's mom. Just a sweet, wonderful, heartfelt movie. I would recommend it to everyone. The movie's called 5 to 7, the number 5 to 7, because these two people meet between 5 and 7 in the evening every day. Because that's when he's done with his college and her diplomat husband hasn't come back yet from his work. It's a lovely movie. I would wholeheartedly recommend it to anyone. 5 to 7.
Lovely.
I'm going to have to put that in our queue. Yeah. Joe.
And my pick is a movie that I actually saw on the back of an airplane a couple months ago. I believe it was over the Christmas period. We were traveling from Tokyo, I think. But it was a movie that, as the plane was leaving the ground, I was using those last moments of cell phone signal to see if
it
was any good or not. So quickly found a Rotten Tomatoes score of 90% and thought, I'm going to go for this. The movie's called I Am Mother. And I'll say that again. I Am Mother, directed by somebody called Grant Putori. It's a directorial debut. And it was released in the middle of last year to obviously not much fanfare. It may have been a straight to Netflix because it does say that the studio here is Netflix. The movie stars Hilary Swank, Claire Rugard as the daughter, and
Rose Byrne. Oh, I heard about it.
As the voice of Mother. So Mother, the basic premise here is Mother is an AI, a robot, and an artificial, you know, some sort of intelligence so it's a sci-fi thriller about a teenage girl who's the first of a new generation of humans to be raised by Mother, a robot who's designed to repopulate the Earth after the extinction of humankind. But the pair's unique relationship is threatened when an injured stranger, Hilary Swank, arrives with news that calls into question everything that daughter has been told about the outside world and Mother's intentions. So this movie it reminds me of some of those old sci-fi classics like Silent Running, if you ever saw something like that. It's, you know, it's a very sparsely populated world. You know, there's only a couple of characters.
Could actually be a stage play.
It could very much be a stage play. And I would imagine its origins are humble in the sense of, you know, this is a first-time director with modest means who's created a world that really is... hermetically sealed, so we don't have to deal with anything coming in from the outside. But it's a wonderful, wonderful premise. And again, I think, you know, one main criticism of the movie could be that it does feel like an extended episode of something like Black Mirror, or perhaps a Twilight Zone, or one of those type of things. Because as the movie kind of progresses through its themes, you can start to see that things aren't what they appear to be, which is not unusual, but then those things aren't what they appear to be, and then those things aren't what they appear to be. So it puts you through a series of reversals and twists, and it's all very, very intelligently done, and it ends very, very satisfyingly, although perhaps one or two twists too many for some, including Rashmi, who I think was I managed to persuade to watch this one with me. But I loved this movie. I thought it was really, really clever, very well executed, and it had kind of an Ex Machina feel to it, although perhaps not as well executed.
I think for me, it just was a little frustrating. I didn't. It didn't all quite come together. It didn't quite. The souffle didn't quite rise for me.
It's not a perfect movie, yeah. But it's definitely...
But it was interesting. I think the concept was interesting. Great production design, great acting. And again, it's this tiny... It feels tiny.
Yeah, I just pulled it up on Netflix and was watching the trailer, and it looks like $1 million. It looks really good. It looks really slick.
It really is, and you know, one of the things that I didn't realize, the voice of Mother was actually Rose Byrne. I love Rose Byrne. Mm. Rose Byrne is just one of those actresses that is so underappreciated, and we often see her in comedic roles as kind of the secondary character. You know, she's very well known for her role in Bridesmaids, which is off to the side of Kristen Wiig, but she steals every scene, and to hear her do this voice of Mother here, there's a very menacing tone that, you know, computer, the artificial intelligence, but she brings a certain weight to it that again makes the movie very tense, because Mother's intentions are never clear. They're never ever clear, and when they become clear, you wonder how well how well intentioned they are. So anyway, a really, really fun little sci-fi movie, and it wasn't that long, so Rashmi, you didn't have to grimace too long. Okay, so our Netflix picks are Rashmi, yours was
Bikram,
and Yasti
5 to 7,
and mine was I Am Mother, all of which I think were from Netflix this week. So correct. Netflix is the winner for this particular episode. Mm-hmm. But as always, plenty to pick and watch on streaming services. So we are indeed living in good times, indeed, for us movie fans.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are.
Okay, two movies to talk about this week in our main section of the podcast. First movie is First Cow, and the next movie is Invisible Man. So I suggest we tackle them in that order, if that works for you.
Sure.
All right, so First Cow.
So First Cow is the latest movie from director Kelly Reichardt. And Kelly Reichardt is a very particular, she's a very quintessential American director. All of her movies, she's kind of almost created her own subcategories of movies that she's made. They're almost always set in the Oregon wilderness. And she did a movie... a few years ago called Certain Women, which had Kristen Stewart in it and Laura Dern and Michelle Williams and others. Before that, she did Wendy and Lucy, which was also a movie with Michelle Williams and a dog. She's quite something. She's very unusual in that all of her movies tend to be very quiet, very, very considered, very slow in terms of revealing their cards. And here is her movie from 2020, her latest movie, and it's called First Cow. And the First Cow is essentially based, it starts off in contemporary times where somebody makes a discovery, and then the rest of the movie plays out about 100 years ago, maybe even before then, at the origins of the great American West, the frontier. Along the Oregon Trail, where people had just started to move in, and by people I mean not the native people, but people from other countries had just started to come in there, and as is described on IMDb, a skilled cook has traveled west and joined a group of fur trappers in Oregon, though he only finds true connection with a Chinese immigrant also seeking his fortune. Soon the two collaborate on a successful business. And that successful business involves a cow, and hence the name First Cow. The first cow here is very literally a first cow. It's not a metaphor for anything else, or maybe it is. But the movie stars mostly unknowns. It stars John Magaro and Orion Lee in the two title characters. And then Toby Jones, who we've known from many movies, he's here, as is Evan Bremmer and Scott Shepard. Alia Shawkat and Lily Gladstone have small roles as well. So this is, Kelly Reichardt movies are very particular. What did you guys think of this one?
So I initially started by thinking it was very unlit and dark to watch for the first 30 minutes. And I think Joe actually turned to me and said, is there something wrong with the bulb? Or the lighting.
Well, so I actually was trying to sling mud at the theater that we watched it, because oftentimes they turn the brightness down to extend the life of the bulb. So I thought, oh, here we go.
Yeah. So I would say for the first 30 minutes, it felt very, very dark. And then I just kept thinking, what is going on here? What time are we in? What's going on? What am I watching? What is this telling me? What the hell is going on? And maybe after about 45 minutes, I thought, it's a fable. And once I let my brain understand that this was a fable of sorts, and it was just a story, I actually started to enjoy it.
So you liked it?
I liked it.
Joe?
I mean, this is a very, very slow burn of a movie. And I think... to say that it takes its time getting anywhere is really, possibly the biggest understatement I've ever made on this podcast. I mean, it's really tough to get through the initial part of the movie for me, because there was nothing to kind of latch on to for me in terms of, things that were happening, people to care about. I can't say that I loved it overall. I mean, I don't think it really rescued itself from that sentiment. It's not my kind of thing. Yes, the NO is going to love this movie. It'll probably make his top 10 of the year. because it's all far too understated. And I think it does leave you with things to think about. And I definitely left the theater with more of a feeling. But if I was to... I'm so glad that you gave me that recap, because if anyone had asked me, like, tell me what happened in that movie, I would have really struggled.
I felt hungry.
Yeah, to say much about it. So, I know. I mean, I don't think this has broad appeal at all. I can see this being the kind of movie that people walk out on, and to see just how well it's reviewed is remarkable to me. But again, I was a big fan of Wendy and Lucy. I did like that movie an awful lot. I'm not familiar with the director's other work, but again, I think this is clearly one of those that are handcrafted for fans of that particular brand.
Yes. Yeah, I think she made a movie called Old Joy way back in 2006, and I think that's what put her on the map. And since then, she made a movie called Meek's Cut Off, with Michelle Williams. I think her most acclaimed movie until this one was Certain Women, which got, I think, at least one Academy Award nomination. I think she prides herself on making movies that are not for everyone. And this is not a movie for everyone. And absolutely, I mean, there is the first 5 minutes of the movie alone is like a test of your patience, because the camera just sits still while this giant
tanker
moves through the ocean at a very, 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 very slow pace. And she has this very, very understated style, and she's the kind of person who, for whom the camera will hold on to a good 5-7 extra seconds after the action is done, right? So something happens and then the camera will just sit there for 5-7 seconds. And I think we are so used to fast cuts and, moving on with the story and finding out where the thread of things are that it's very disorienting. And I suspect this movie will not play well in Peoria or otherwise, if people have gone in expecting a particular kind of movie. So it's a whole other kind of food. It's very slow. It's very, I think the movie has to get it has to get at least halfway through its running time before it becomes obvious what the main story is about, because you just see some characters behaving in particular ways. And like you said, it took me a long time to realize that we had moved away from contemporary times into some time way back into the past, because there is no little placard which says 200 years ago or 150 years ago. So the movie, and I think that's been her style all along, she expects you to kind of fill in the blanks, you know, and little pieces of information are given. But I think at the end of the day, once it gets going, I think this might actually be one of her most accessible movies, because it's not a script she herself wrote. It's based on a novel, so she's adapting this novel, and it has a, you know, once it gets into the plot, the plot is pretty straightforward, and at that point it becomes about so many things. It becomes about the nature of capitalism. It becomes about who has right over property. It becomes about if I see a resource that I'm using to make something which a lot of people want, am I the bad guy here?
Hmm.
So it has a lot of things to ask about the nature of industry. And it has, you know, it is about oily cakes. And it's about the most loving, sweet cow that you'll ever see. I love that cow. If I hadn't already stopped eating red meat, this would make me stop eating red meat.
And friendship. I think the movie's, the movie's about core friendship.
And an unlikely friendship. I wish it had actually spent more time there than wasting time on the tanker,
yeah.
Right? I mean, I think there are a lot of, as a result of this slow burn, there's a lot of wasted time when it could have been spent in the effort of the story itself. I think that was my frustration with it. Much as I liked it by the end, I think you have to go in knowing, almost like Midsommar in some ways, right? It's a long movie. And nothing happens and then everything happens. And then it felt the same here, like nothing really happens and then everything happens.
Yeah, and I was just amazed. I was reading one of the other reviews, and I'm just fascinated by frontier land. Like how when people first reached out to wild open lands, you know, how did they react to it? Did they take advantage of it? Did they settle in? Did they respect it? And, you know, just the lives they led at that time. There was no electricity. There was no water running. Everything you did, you had to kind of depend on nature. Things that you bartered with. You bartered with pieces of tile, and you bartered with little broken coins. And so for me, it
was... Beaver pelts.
And beaver pelts. I mean, this guy, the main
trading,
character...
Trading, right?
They were trading outposts 100 years ago in the middle of nowhere. And that, the details to that and the production design for that, and you know, how do you authentically convey that? I was just fascinated by that. There's a man in there. I think it's only a single shot, but there's a man who has a crow on his back or a raven or something on his shoulder, who's kind of staring out while at the marketplace. And I was curious to know the story about that man and the crow. These are all like stories about people in the old, you know, 100 years ago, and what kind of lives they led, and how harsh it was, you know, living in those times. So I just lapped all that up. I mean, for me, the movie does kind of end like a gentle epic, and in terms of it has such a sweet heart, and it wants to tell the story about a friendship. It leaves enough things unexplained that you could kind of talk about it for a long time, but I couldn't get enough of it. By the time it had gotten to its groove, I wanted this movie to go another hour, and I wanted the story to carry on. But you know, I like her movies. And it takes her movies take a lot of getting used to.
I get the sense that the movie would make a lot more sense. Like, the structure is odd in the sense of a lot of the information that you need to process the goings on, you don't get until very, very deep into the movie. So I almost kind of want to go back and watch those early scenes again, because knowing what I know about the world and the characters and the situation, would any of those conversations have more context? I felt like I lacked the appropriate context up front. And that's just a very frustrating thing for me. You know, I think other people don't mind kind of absorbing those moments and then putting them into a context in their mind later on. I need to know what's happening right in front of me at any given point in time. And so, you know, I think that kind of direction is frustrating to
me. I think it's interesting because we spend a good 10 minutes at the beginning getting to the point where the story really jumps back. And it has no relevance other than it's someone stumbling upon something that kind of sets us into the story then, you know. And I just thought that was an interesting choice.
In fact, thank you. I mean, that's absolutely right. I forgot completely about the fact that the movie does make that time leap, right? I mean, that you're right. It doesn't
explain. And I think you're right, Yasta. You know, she expects you to be intelligent enough to understand what's happened. But there's a lot of time spent at that first 10 minutes of the movie. And then it means nothing.
Well, it's a device.
Yeah, it's a device.
It's a device.
And it's interesting. Made me think, okay, that's what this is about.
Right.
And then once I kind of figured that out, then I was like, okay, now it feels more like a sweet fable that I could kind of get into.
Yeah, and I loved the questions the movie is asking in terms of, you know, there were a lot of cows apparently on the East Coast of America in about 100 years ago, but there weren't any in the Pacific Northwest. And to Oregon and Washington, the first cow had to be brought in by ship, you know, from Europe. And
would have been very expensive.
Very, very expensive. And, you know, that cow lost its, the male cow didn't make it, and it was only the female cow. And it was owned by this cow is the possession of this landowner who almost doesn't know what to do with it. And it's almost a prestige thing. And the fact that these two simple men decide to use some of that cow's milk to kind of make a living out of it by making these amazing baked goods. You know, what are the morals of that? You know, are they thieves or are they just, you know, the first people to take in, you know, and jump on industry, you know, and what right does that owner have to that cow? And it's all these amazing questions, which, yeah, granted, if you're too turned off by the movie by that point, then you will not be in that pensive mood.
So. Yeah. And I do like the banter between the gentleman, you know, the nobleman of the era about what are the men wearing in Paris these right. days? And, you know, just it's funny. It's humorous as well. But again, I think it just takes too long to get there.
And sorry, one other thing is I found the politics of race around that time fascinating in terms of, you know, how the Native Americans had kind of blended in and kind of found their place in servitude to, you know, to make a living at that time in the service of, you know, the colonialists who had come there. So there's so much here to kind of parse through.
Score.
I really truly love this movie. I think
I knew it.
Nobody makes movies like this, honestly. And I think it's an investment. The movie is an investment, and you can't go in. You know, if we are all so used to fast moving things. And this sitting down for this movie, it's like a meditation, and it may really turn people off and people will walk out. But I think if you sit through it, the movie has its charms. It has a very gentle, loving sensibility about it. You know, just the central relationship between an American man and a Chinese immigrant who become friends and decide to, you know, help each other in at that time is so lovely. So I do see it like a little epic almost, very, very simple, nice epic. 8.5 out of 10, which I'm going to back down to 8. It's quite something.
This is the anti-Michael Bay
movie,
if there ever was one. The complete opposite of that. I don't think it's for everyone, like Joe said, but I think if you do let it wash over you, you should be awake fully to watch this. I'll give this a 6.5 out of 10, which I'll back down to a 6.
You did a half, finally.
And As much as I've said I struggled with the movie, I mean, I want people to know that I didn't hate the experience. I think the experience frustrated me because of a general lack of I call it a lack of intelligence on my part, perhaps lack of context in the early scenes. So it's kind of a frustrating movie, and that makes it really hard for me to recommend this to, because I just don't know who I could say, you gotta go see First Cow, it's right up your alley, you'll have a blast. I don't know that anyone that I could think of, other than maybe Yazdi, that I could wholehearted, or perhaps members of the Film Critics Society, but, you know, your typical, and I don't want to dumb down audiences and say that I'm anything above anyone else, but honestly, as a bog standard moviegoer, I couldn't say to anyone, like, go see First Cow.
But so, she's so cute, the first cow.
The first cow is indeed rather cute. but we're having steak for dinner later tonight, so the less said about that, the better. So, yeah, I'm going to give it a 5 out of 10, which is a real stingy,
it is stingy
movie. And in actuality, I'll say that listening to the two of you discuss the movie has bumped that up from a 4.
Ooh, okay, because
I was very, very ready to kind of tear this one a new one. Okay, so First Cow, from First Cow to The Invisible Man. So, Rashmi, are you going to tell us about The Invisible Man?
So when Cecilia's abusive ex takes his own life and leaves her his fortune, she suspects his death was a hoax. As a series of coincidences turn lethal, Cecilia works to prove that she is being hunted by someone no one can see. So this is directed by Leigh Whannell, and also written by Leigh Whannell. And it stars Elizabeth Moss, Oliver Jackson Cohen, Harriet Dyer, and a few others. Mostly unknowns, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, Yazdi, is this one worth going to see, or should it remain invisible?
I think it's totally worth going out and seeing. I again, maybe it's a question of expectations. I was expecting another. It's from Universal, who owned the original rights to the monster feature. You know, the original Jules Verne story of the Invisible Man. And then there was the Hollow Man. There was a version which came out about 10, 15 years ago with Kevin Bacon, I believe, in the title role. And then this was, I said, well, okay, here they are again, rolling out an old property for yet another world through it. But I really like what this movie does. I think like many good movies, first and foremost, it's just such a good ride. It's just so entertaining. The movie had its hooks on me from the very first scene. You know, about this woman played by Elizabeth Moss waking up in the middle of the night and somehow trying to get out of the house. And we don't know why she's trying to escape the house. We don't know what's going on. It just got its hooks on me. And I think a lot of that comes from good craft. You know, it's just a very well put together film. So I think if you want to see a Friday night movie and just be thoroughly entertained, then you could hardly go wrong. And, you know, it has Elizabeth Moss, who deserves her time in the sun. And I think maybe this movie will bring her the mainstream audiences that she so richly deserves. I mean, she takes a stock woman in peril, woman trying to fight back against an evil force, woman that nobody believes. And she just at every step makes it so completely believable. You step aside from that, I'm rambling, but you step aside from that, and the movie is also about the current Me Too era, about, you know, women and how they're treated by men. And so it gives a little bit more relevance. And I think this Leigh Whannell's version, I think the best thing it has done is all the previous versions of the movie have been from the perspective of the Invisible Man. Who is never morally right. But in this case, the whole movie is seen through the eyes of the woman who has to deal with the Invisible Man. So I think that's a very, very smart move. Surprisingly good. Very, very good.
Joe?
I was surprised at how much of an all-out horror movie this was. I think I was not expecting that going in. I thought maybe a thriller, but it really does very quickly... let you know it's in the horror genre, because you know it has jump scares in it, and they're not I think some of them are a little of the cheaper type nature, but they do very well to you know, build the movie suspense. Yeah, it's kind of an interesting movie. I wish I had liked it more. I wanted to like it more. I felt that the direction was extremely competent. So, you know, Yazdi, you kind of, you know, nailed it in terms of that opening scene with the sheer non-verbal storytelling that is happening in that scene, right? We see so many little details that start very quickly, unlike the other movie, to put into context the images on the screen. And so we know very, very quickly what's happening without necessarily understanding the background. And that kind of thing sits well with me. The other thing that this movie does really well, and it kind of apes the movie It Follows a couple of years ago, where the camera starts to look in a certain direction, and we're so primed as movie viewers to, when a camera's looking at an empty space, you know, and the movie's called The Invisible Man, like, we know we're looking at something that, you know, and the movie It Follows did this a couple of years ago, where, you know, there was always something in the distance that was walking towards us, even though we might not necessarily perceive it in that moment. We know that when the camera switched to that direction, that the thing that was following was coming from that direction. So this movie kind of felt like it borrowed that idea here with setting up lots of shots where, you know, there's a shot of an empty seat. Well, you know, knowing that the movie's called The Invisible Man, that places a very high likelihood that there is. And the movie kind of jumps back and forth with that. You know, sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't. But yeah, it was good. I mean, I think thematically it was an interesting choice as well. You know, this notion of, you know, this very controlling individual. I started to struggle with the lengths that this person would go to punish this woman. Like, I didn't buy that setup, right? I mean, yes, I get that it was a controlling individual, but, you know, I just rewatched the Steve Jobs movie in there, and I see the kind of you know, psychological manipulation that a person puts on others. We didn't get deep enough with that, so buying the fact that he would be such a vengeful force is a bit of a struggle for me. But anyway, you know, a good thriller of a movie. Rashmi.
So I think this is Unsane. Remember the Steven Soderbergh movie from a few years ago with Claire Foy? This is Unsane meets Sleeping with the Enemy. Mm-hmm. It has great effects, but I think for me, I wish there had been more time in the setup to let us know exactly, so that we could buy into the why she's running away from him and why he's going to all the lengths to try and bring her back. I like that it plays like a horror, but I actually wanted the Invisible Man of the 70s, you know, the David McCallum 70s series. I wanted that Invisible Man, and this played much more.
The man with a hat and long
coat.
Yeah,
you know, the scientist where something goes wrong. Like, that's the Invisible Man I want, not the Hollow Man, which I think this played much more like an evil presence, as opposed to, you know, a science experiment that's gone wrong. So I think what it gave us was adequate, but it felt long for the amount of story that it covered. And so I wish there had been maybe a bit more lead up. And then I did like how it all tied up in the end. I liked the kind of the aha, got you twists and turns. I didn't expect some of those. But there was a bit in the middle where it didn't quite make sense. Like, why is she staying with this family? Who are they to her? Why is the sister on the periphery? It didn't quite hold together in the middle a little bit for me. But she's great. It's a great Friday night decompress, I think.
Yeah, I just think the movie's so well crafted. I mean, you know, after watching a few horror movies, somebody told me, you know, you can keep your eyes closed. And I was like, oh God, yeah, I can do that. So when things get really, really scary, I close my eyes.
Yeah,
I close my eyes in this movie a good two or three times, because I'm like, I don't want to deal with this. I do not want to deal with this. I'm just going to close my eyes.
Don't go into the attic.
Yeah.
No, in the middle of the night. Why would you go to the attic in the middle of the night?
And the tropes are great, right? She calls the number, the phone rings behind her.
Right.
I mean, those are excellent tropes. I do love the horror tropes. It does it well. It was more effect than story. That's my problem. Good effects, great effects.
Yeah, and I also like how the movie kind of... So there's the physical aspect, right? Of, you know, oh, there's a hat which is moving, and clearly there's a man underneath it. There's the physical part, but I think the movie really makes good use of the fact that if somebody's truly invisible, how they can use that to ruin somebody. And, you know...
The vengeance.
The vengeance part, because, you know, he plays games with her where... She comes off like an insane person. She's
gaslighting.
Total gaslighting. And that's why I think the movie kind of has a little bit more relevance right now in our Me Too era, because it's like the invisible man becomes every evil man who is kind of doing wrong to a woman who the world won't listen to. She's been telling everybody.
Oh, I like that.
Right? She's been telling everyone that this is bad. Bad things are happening, but nobody will listen to her. They will just say she's insane or whatever. So I think it's a good metaphor for that. But I just like there's a great scene in the restaurant that she goes to, which just comes out of nowhere. There's all kinds of the scene in the attic.
There's a great really slap.
There's a great slap. There's a tupper.
That slap was brilliant. I was like, what?
Yeah,
was a great moment.
And the repercussions from the slap, right? I mean, the repercussions from the slap are so gigantic. So I think whoever has kind of rewritten the story has really thought it through. So I agree. I think it leaves some blanks to be filled by the viewer. But I think that might even be deliberate. And I like how it all fits together. I mean, at the end of the day, she is put in a mental asylum and she has nobody to depend on. And that's when she realizes she has no effing thing to lose. And she just decides to take things in her own hands. So I like the whole arc of the story as well. So I think it's so much better than it needs to be.
It's fun. It is fun. I'll give you that.
Yeah. Okay. So I'll start by wrapping it up. I'll give it an 8 out of 10 because it's such a good, and I don't even like horror, but it's suspenseful, it's scary. And God, any movie which gives more exposure to Elizabeth Moss is good by me. 8 out of 10. Go see it, everyone.
I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10 in part because I think even though I think the movie's, action and... overall kind of pacing were very well done. You know, this movie generates fear and suspense very effectively. I do feel like the story was a little rough around the edges and left me a little frustrated and ultimately not satisfied that the motives of the Invisible Man were A, plausible, but B, genuine. So a little bit of a frustrating one for me because I think it deserves just a few more minutes in the writing room, just like I say, it's not one that I can easily come back to because of that. So 7 out of 10.
What Joe said, 7 out of 10.
Okay.
All right, well, we've babbled on for almost 50 minutes here, so I'll bring the podcast to a close. Thank you very much for listening. We do appreciate you taking the time to download and listen to Movie Wallahs. We are on Facebook at facebook.com/MovieWallahs, on Instagram at instagram.com/MovieWallahs, Twitter, and probably something else that's escaping me right now. So do check us out. We would love to hear from you, interact with us, like our posts, share our posts, mail at moviewallahs.com as well if you'd like to get hold of us. So until our next episode, it's Too Many Movies, Too Little Time. A goodbye from me.
And me as well.
And me too.
And hashtag me too, Yesti.
Oh my God.
No.
No.